Welcome back to The Roundtable. I'm Ian Pickus. With the country poised to mark the 50th anniversary of President Kennedy's assassination, a new round of memorials, conspiracy theories, and national temperature taking has commenced. The world before that Dallas day was markedly different from our world today. Most of the social turmoil of the 60s was still ahead of America, and the country's top foe on the world stage was the USSR. Of course, the murder of JFK changed everything. In the half-century since, most of the attention paid to the shooter Lee Harvey Oswald has focused on his whereabouts in the few hours before and after the assassination, and a cottage industry of conspiracists have spent their lives trying to prove that such a bold act had to be the work of a web of sinister forces, not one disaffected and listless American. In his new book, Peter Savodnik deals with the crucial years Oswald spent in Russia, arguing that Oswald's brief life constituted a series of moves and failures, including an ill-advised foray into the USSR based on a surface-level affinity for communism. The interloper, Lee Harvey Oswald, Inside the Soviet Union, is out now from Basic Books, and it's my pleasure to welcome Peter Savodnik to the Roundtable.
Thank you.
I wanted to start off talking about Lee Harvey Oswald's mother, because in her absence, she had much to do with the way he saw the world and a lot of his failure. So what was she like, and what kind of influence did she have on him?
She was a very, very, you might say, harried personality, very dependent, very undependable. Oswald moved 20 times before he enlisted in the Marines at the age of 17, and each of these moves was the result of one of Marguerite's, one of his mother's, many failures, losing a job, the end of a relationship with a man, and so on. So they have this really unhealthy relationship where, on the one hand, she's very dependent on him. They have this overly tight relationship. They apparently slept in the same bed until he was 10. On the other hand, he comes to resent her deeply, and by the time he's in 12 or 13, wants to get out as quickly as possible.
He had also several maybe half-siblings or step-siblings. Those relationships they ran hot and cold in his life. Tell us about the other members of his family.
Well, there were two older brothers, or I should say one older brother, one older half-brother. There's Robert Oswald, his older brother, and there was John Pick, his older half-brother. And Robert, in particular, was close to his brother. The sad thing was that for Oswald was that they were never really a permanent fixture in his life. They clearly wanted to know him better, to be a better, more of a part of his life, but they were older, and because of Marguerite's constant moving around, there was really never an opportunity for all of them to be together for long periods of time. So there is about Oswald a very kind of fractured sense of family and place and connection.
Now let's fast forward a little and talk about his joining the Marines. How did that happen?
So the Marines should be viewed simply as an escape hatch, a way out. Oswald, from the age of probably 12, really wanted to get away from Marguerite as fast as he could. And he thought of the Marines were sort of an option in his mind because he knew about them. His brothers had served in the military, and so it was an easy way to flee. I don't think that he had any particular affinity for the Marines per se, but he just wanted a way out. The other thing about the Marines that it's worth pointing out is that they offered Oswald a real focus and structure and organization, and he clearly intuited that this was something that would be good for him. The problem is he would learn once he enlisted, and he would learn the same lesson again in the Soviet Union, was that the very thing that he thought he needed most, structure, organization, a sense of purpose and rootedness, was what he found most difficult to integrate into his life.
During his life in the Marines, he was known to say provocative things to several of his fellow Marines, you know, starting to show some interest in communism or at least looking to get a rise out of people. So he always struggled to make friends and to keep relationships. What kind of relationships did he have in the Marines, and what did people think of him?
He didn't really have anything that you could call a relationship with anyone. He had sort of fleeting acquaintances with people with whom he served. Probably the guy who knew him best there, maybe for a while, was Daniel Powers, his superior officer. They served together in Japan, and they spent a lot of time together when they were traveling from San Diego to Japan on this Navy ship. So, and they actually wound up playing a lot of chess together. So they had these sort of weird conversations. But it would be incorrect to suggest that Oswald sort of forged meaningful relationships with anyone. He wasn't really capable of that kind of thing. The closest he comes to establishing any kind of real ties with people doesn't happen until Minsk.
Okay, well, we've gone there now. So take us to the kind of faux defection. There's some very interesting games happening between Oswald and the U.S. Embassy. They sort of try to shield him from full renunciation of the United States. So how does he go on to enter the USSR?
So he arrives in Moscow on this six-day tourist visa in October 1959, and he immediately informs the Soviet authorities that he wants to stay forever. He wants to start a new life there. And they inform him after his visa is up that, in fact, they don't want him, and he's going to have to go home. He attempts to kill himself. The KGB sort of throws up its hands in exasperation and says, well, in essence, if you want to stay that much, okay, but they make him wait for 2 months. I think there's a good bit of testing going on to see how he will react to this. And then they ship him off to Minsk, which is this provincial town, far away from anything important, which was very much intended. The Americans at the embassy were worried about Oswald, not so much because of him, but because there had been this recent uptick in the number of defections of Americans defecting to the Soviet Union. Not a lot, but a larger number than usual. And there was a fear of Americans being recruited, or of intelligence problems or issues, propaganda. So they tried to convey to Oswald the seriousness of defecting, and what they did is they held on to his passport. And this would prove, of course, critical 2.5 years later when Oswald wanted to return to the United States, because no one could prevent him from doing that at the time, then, because he was an American still.
Some people thought that he was a very intelligent man, and in as much as he was educated, he was an autodidact. But you quote from him extensively in the book, and it's clear in his own writings that, you know, he had a lot of trouble with grammar. He was not a good speller. A lot of his writings are sort of disjointed and hard to read. So the question is, how much did he really understand about this Marxism and this communism that he was professing to be interested in terms of the larger entry into the USSR?
Yeah, I think that's a fascinating question, and I think it's one that is very hard to answer. On the one hand, Oswald certainly knew a good bit more about the Soviet Union, Marxism, current events in a more general sense than many other people from his background with his level of education, formal education. At the same time, as you point out, he was probably what we would call today dyslexic, and clearly undereducated and lacked any of the sophistication or intellectual girth that one would expect from somebody who makes a serious jump or sort of a political migration like Oswald did. So it's hard to avoid the conclusion that he was smart enough to sort of integrate this vocabulary and some of these ideas into his speaking, into his letter writing, his diary entries, but never really pierced beyond the superficial, and never really was able to acquire the kind of historical or political consciousness that one would expect with a real revolutionary. So I think there's a good bit of sort of pretending, but I'm not sure that Oswald was necessarily aware that he was pretending.
Yeah, I mean, you could be a provocateur in the Marines. He could have stayed there. He could have gone back to the U.S. and handed out left-wing leaflets as much as he liked, but he actually followed through and got a factory line job and moved into Belarus as we know it today. So why did he take that next step of putting his money where his mouth was and actually putting down roots there?
Yeah, I think that the mistake here is to view the defection as essentially an ideological move. I don't think that was what it was at all. I think it was essentially personal or psychological. And I think it's cloaked in this ideological garb. I don't think that Oswald was aware of this. I think that he believed that he was defecting, that he was a committed Marxist and so on. But really what's driving him, what's fueling all of this this anger and this militancy is this intense desire to leave his mother, to leave his old life alone behind, and to forge a new life. And this is laid bare in his early letters home and his early diary entries. And it explains the intensity with which he defects. And it explains why he manages to soldier on despite some pretty steep climbs early on in the Soviet Union. So, I think that, again, like his understanding of communism and the Soviet Union, there is a superficial ideology about all this, but beneath all that is essentially personal history and psychology.
What was his day-to-day life like in the USSR?
In the beginning, he was a celebrity. He was a novelty, and this represented the high watermark of his Soviet period. But then, after not too long, the dreariness and mechanization of day-to-day life in Minsk began to settle in. He worked in the experimental department at the Minsk radio factory, which meant that he was one of many metal lathe operators whose job it was to weld together prototypes of new television sets that would be tried out and then shipped off to Moscow, and some apparatchik there would take a look and decide whether this was going to be mass-produced and shipped off. So he was a guy who sat in front of this table all day long with little bits and pieces and files and blowtorches and things like that. But his apartment was a few minutes from work. There was a music conservatory near him where he could go to concerts, the opera house, which he frequented. There was the Foreign Language Institute, which had many girls who, as Russians might put it, a little bit were a little bit more adventurous. They were eager to meet Americans or an American. So he had a pretty good life as far as the Russians were concerned. It's just he didn't know how to adapt to this life, although he thought that he had wanted it very much.
Let's talk about his social life during this time. There were two women really most important. Eventually, he would bring one of them back to the U.S. as his wife and with a child. But there was one who came before that really influenced him and the way he looked at his larger experience there. So tell us about his outside of work life in the USSR.
So Ella German, the woman you're referring to, he meets her just a few months after he arrives at the factory, if that, and he is taken with her immediately. She's rather innocent and probably just enjoyed spending time with him. He was a novelty. He was something new, and he was from far away, so that made him interesting. Oswald probably never appreciated that she was just sort of taken with him as an American and never really actually fell for him. And then finally, there's this moment on New Year's Eve where he, or the day after New Year's Eve, where he proposes to her. This does not go well, and this precipitates his thinking about leaving the Soviet Union, which is delayed after he meets Marina Prusakova, his future wife, at this ball.
And how does he eventually sour on life there and decide to come back to the U.S.?
He had been sort of grappling with certain uncertainties or anxieties about his life in the Soviet Union for several months. And those things probably would have receded somewhat had Ella decided to marry him. She had no intention or desire, as far as we know, to leave the Soviet Union. And had she said yes, probably would have insisted on them staying in Minsk. And of course, the whole you know, trajectory of you know, history would be very different then. But what happened is that she said no, and this just greatly exacerbated his feelings of dislocation and disorientation and his unhappiness. So this begins the period in which Oswald really takes, you know, his preliminary steps to extricate himself from the Soviet Union. What puts that on hold briefly is his courtship of his meeting and then his courtship of Marina Prusakova, whom he meets in March of 1961.
And he eventually becomes something of a man without a country, because in the USSR he had been really this question mark. And once it was clear that he didn't have any great intelligence about the U.S., he became much less valuable to the Russians. But then on his way back into the U.S., he is just the same, a real question mark. You know, is he coming back at the behest of the KGB? How much does he know about Russia that can help the U.S., or what kind of tabs need to be kept on him? So diplomatically, what was the process like for him to re-enter?
So there's this tension within the U.S. government about how to think about Oswald. There were people at the Immigration and Naturalization Service who did not want him to come back. They were keenly aware of things that Oswald had said when he first arrived in the Soviet Union. He had offered to give the Russians military intelligence, which he didn't have, but he offered in any event. He had made some very vituperative comments about wanting to you know, bear arms against the United States in the event that it came to that. So there's a real militancy about Oswald, and this was not lost on the people at INS. The State Department had a somewhat different take. Their feeling was that it was more important to look at the bigger picture, and it would be much more useful to the United States to keep this family reunited. That is, or I should say united. The Americans couldn't keep Oswald out, but they could keep Marina out. So the State Department had argued for keeping them all together and for allowing for safe passage of Oswald, Marina, and their new baby, June, back to the United States in the name of not only good relations, but really of America being a country that supports good family relations and that is not going to break up families. It would have been bad PR, in their opinion. And so there was a decision on the part of some higher ups at the State Department to kind of push INS to clear the way for Oswald and for Marina's paperwork. And that's how eventually, in June 1962, they were able to leave.
First of all, you believe and state that Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone. This was the act of a disaffected and ultimately homicidal actor, one person, and then you state that outright. So let's start there and just talk about, have you gotten pushback from people who disagree on that point? And, you know, why are you convinced?
Look, there are more than 5 million pages in the Kennedy file at the U.S. National Archives. If you want to come to the conclusion that there was a conspiracy, you can do that. You can select certain data points and piece them together and decide that, in fact, the mafia did this, or the KGB, or Fidel Castro. But if you take into account all of the data, including Lee Harvey Oswald's biography and psychology, it's impossible to sustain any of the conspiracy theories. So I began the investigation, the work into the book, by asking the question, who was Oswald really? And the Soviet foray was so important because it was there that Oswald's whole kind of mind and all of his ambitions and his fears and anxieties and in many ways his greatest successes are exposed, are kind of laid out for us to examine or explore. And that's what makes it such an important period. And you can really get a sense of who Oswald was by paying attention to this period. But when you take into account who he was, when you really look at him not as a cog in somebody else's detective story, but as a three-dimensional character, as his own man, it becomes abundantly clear rather fast that not only was he capable of the assassination, but it was highly likely that there was going to be something like the homicidal, suicidal explosion that takes place on November 22nd, 1963.
So he comes back, and again, his life is a series of stops and starts. At some point, he picks up a gun, and now he has a completely different aim aside from the political points before, you know, embracing communism, moving to the USSR. Now he's become violent, and that's where your book ends.
Right.
But I wonder, why did you think that that ended up being his only way out?
Well, the violence, in fact, is not new. It courses through his life from early adolescence until the very end. Starting at, I think age 12, you know, he hits his mother and he lashes out at his sister-in-law with this pocket knife, which is, to say the least, atypical. And he is consistently incapable of fitting in, of adapting. He's constantly the outsider who sort of brings trouble upon himself because he's incapable of integrating whatever experiences are being sort of imposed on him into his own experience. He's always on the outs, or on the outside, I should say. And so the idea of violence as a part of Oswald's life is there from almost from the beginning, and so the attempt on Edwin Walker's life 6 months before or 7 months before the assassination is just the further ratcheting up of that, and of course the assassination is the culmination. But all of this represents this kind of violent force that seems to weave its way through Oswald's life from the time he is 12 or 13 until he's killed at 24.
Do you think there was any one person, maybe even lower than the bureaucratic level, who could have stopped him here?
If you mean, could anyone have stopped the assassination of John F. Kennedy from happening? Probably not. What is so hard, I think, for many Americans to appreciate is that the assassination of John F. Kennedy has very little to do with John F. Kennedy. It has almost everything to do with Lee Harvey Oswald. And it is because of that that it was so hard to make sense of what happened. It was certainly impossible to detect that this was going to happen. Oswald had never said anything that indicated any kind of hostility toward the president. If anything, he had made a few comments that suggested that he was vaguely supportive of him. So the point is that there are no clues. There's nothing that indicates this is going to happen. But what is clear is that Oswald was, at this point, by the fall of 1963, something akin to a ticking time bomb. He was desperately trying to escape the life that he had been confined to. He tries to, flee at the very last minute to Cuba and then on to the Soviet Union. He fails. He comes back to the United States. And the only reason that he doesn't implode or explode sooner is that his second daughter is born in October of 1963, and this delays for a month or so any kind of violent conclusion. But then, of course, by early mid-November of 1963, his rage has reemerged, and he learns that Kennedy is coming to Dallas, and it all sort of comes together. But that's the way to view the assassination, not as some carefully concocted plot that unfolds over several months or years.
That's Peter Savodnik. He's the author of The Interloper, Lee Harvey Oswald Inside the Soviet Union. And Peter, it's just been a pleasure to speak about this dark chapter with you, and I thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Ian.
And you're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.